Welcome to the Capital News. I'm your host, Alex Kritis. Today is Thursday, February 25th, 2021. Thank you so much for joining me. Title of today's podcast, Fragile Markets. That's putting it mildly. We've been talking about the fragility of markets for the past couple of years since this podcast has been online. Nothing has changed except that it's gotten worse. It's become more fragile because there is no real organic growth that is keeping this economy up and keeping this economy moving forward. This is artificial fiscal and monetary efforts. And they want to cram another $1.9 trillion of money that we don't have down our throats into the system. Yet at the same time, they also want to tell us, our fearless leaders, that the economy is coming back. That this year, GDP for the year is going to grow 5, 6, 7%. A number we haven't seen here in this country in decades. So if that's going to be the case, 5, 6, 7% GDP, and of course there's a big difference in that one percentage point across the board, believe me, on a $20 trillion economy, that's a big number. But nonetheless, that, I guess, is without the $1.9 trillion factored in and a whole host of other spending measures that likely is going to come down the pike, because the Democrats and the Biden administration are not done. They're just getting warmed up. These are the very early innings. And if they can push things through in budget reconciliation through the Senate, well, again, we're just getting started. These are the very early innings of this spending spree of more money that we don't have. So if the economy is so strong, or it's going to be so strong in the coming quarters throughout this year, then why do we continue to throw more money into the system? Why does the Federal Reserve remain committed to throwing another $120 billion of liquidity into the system by purchasing treasuries and by purchasing mortgage-backed securities? And of course, that's not what they're just limited to. They can go out and buy other things if they want to. They can declare an emergency, though. I mean, yeah, they're handcuffed a little bit on some of these other asset classes, going into corporate bonds, what have you. Some of these things have expired. But nonetheless, if they need to do it, they'll come up with a reason. They'll come up with an excuse. They'll force the hand of Congress to pass something, an emergency measure that allows the Fed to get involved somewhere else down the line. And who knows? We've heard from Treasury Secretary Janet Dingbat Yellen many times hinting, you got to read between the lines, that, you know, it might be a proper measure for the Federal Reserve to go into the markets and actually purchase stocks outright. Now, this wouldn't make the United States unique in this if that should happen. This is what the Bank of Japan does. This is what the Swiss National Bank does. They go into the marketplace and they buy stocks. Now, I believe the Bank of Japan is limited to buying ETFs in Japan. But the Swiss National Bank, I think they can buy stocks wherever they want to. I know they have U.S. stocks on their books. So understand what this means. You have a central bank that is granted the permission and the authority to print a nation's currency. It's counterfeiting, because if you do it, that's what they call it. They call it counterfeiting. You can't do it, but they can. And then they can go out into the real world and buy real assets. They can buy stocks. They can buy bonds. They can buy real estate. They can go out and buy mines. They can buy the real stuff. This is the world in which we live. This is the economy that we have built, and it is becoming extremely fragile because these people have taken it to its limits. Talk about that here all the time. We're hitting a point of exhaustion. Can they run this thing higher? Absolutely they can, and they are going to do everything they can to do that. They're going to change the narrative. They're going to throw more liquidity into the system. They're going to say, we got to do more at the fiscal level. Yada, yada, yada. They are going to throw everything at the kitchen sink at this to get these markets higher once again. And they may prove successful, at least for a short period of time. The question is, when do the markets push back and say enough is enough? Because that's when you know it's game, set, match. That's when you know this game is over. When the markets call BS, and the Feds and the Federal Reserve, other central banks and federal governments around the world continue to throw everything at the kitchen sink into the markets, and the markets say, nope, ain't happening. That's it, because they're not going to have any other tool left. They're not going to be able to say or do anything to stop the inevitable return to reality. So there's not going to be many asset classes that are going to be safe from a drawdown. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a crash, although I think the first leg down probably will resemble a crash. I think we're in for a long-term bear market once all of this dust settles. Timing, of course, is always the question. It's a tough thing to do. I don't attempt to do it here. I am just noting the risks and the fragility that exist within the system. We cannot continue to go on these measures. And this is when we're in lockdown, people. We have almost a global economy in some form of restriction or lockdown. And we have stocks at all-time highs on price and valuation. We have bond prices at all-time highs. Although some of this is starting to get undone. Some of this is... But of course, what caused the major sell-off today and what's been causing some of the sell-off over the past several trading sessions is the fact that we continue to see the yields rising in treasuries, especially at the 10-year note and the 30-year long bond, which of course we'll get to today. That's going to be the crux of our conversation, which it has been for the past couple of weeks. We've been noting that this is something to pay close attention to, and this is exactly why. The bond market dwarfs the stock market. You're going to get more realistic signals coming out of the bond market than we are the stock market, even though both of them are busted, both of them are greatly manipulated, because that's what quantitative easing has done. It was supposed to be a temporary monetary experiment during the depths of the great financial crisis. Once it did what it was supposed to do, okay, now it's time to get out. Well, we've been doing this for 12 years, and there's no end in sight. We know that the Fed wants to continue with this nonsense for at least this year, throughout the remainder of this year. And if you know what hits the fan, that's their only tool. So they're going to continue to do more of it. And as we continue to see these yields continue to climb, we're likely going to hear the next portion of the narrative being yield curve control, which we mentioned last week before Jay Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve, went before Congress this week. Now, there wasn't much conversation on that part. A little bit of discussion on inflation, of course. But that seems to be, you know, something that they can easily sweep under the rug, that the Fed can see inflation coming, and that they have the tools in their toolbox to make sure it doesn't get out of hand. That's a bunch of hogwash, but that's their narrative. The other argument that they're pushing, of course, is these yields are increasing because people are starting to price in growth within the economy. I think that's hogwash too. I think what the market is starting to sniff out is inflationary pressures, which are already here, but now it's finally making its way into the bond market. And the reason it's taken so long is because the bond market has been vastly manipulated. That's what quantitative easing is. It's buying treasuries, bidding up the price, putting pressure, downward pressure on the yields. That's how it works. So what's the Fed to do? What are other central banks to do? Well, we see the Reserve Bank of Australia made an unscheduled $2 billion purchase with respect to their bonds today. They're nervous, folks. They are trapped, and they know it. The Bank of Korea did the same thing, going in and buying their bonds. Nobody wants bonds of these countries. There's no market. That was something Jay Powell told us this week. He said, oh, no, there's robust demand for U.S. debt. That's a bunch of hogwash, too, because there was a Treasury auction today, and there were no bids. Nobody wanted it because it's all junk. Nobody wants U.S. debt except the Federal Reserve. Nobody wants European debt except the ECB. And round we go. Pick a country, pick its central bank. That's where the demand's coming from. That's it. The printing press, because we are going to have a motherload of debt issuance put onto the market. We don't have $1.9 trillion. So where are we going to get it? Well, we got to borrow it. What about the Green New Deal? What about infrastructure? What about healthcare? What about God knows else what? We don't have the money. You have to issue the bonds. This is supply and demand. There is no demand. There's a ton of supply. Prices collapse. Yields go up. This is not growth. This is inflation. And if it was growth, then we would have been seeing a stronger dollar. We should be seeing a much stronger movement in the dollar index. It should be moving much higher with it if it was growth. But it's not. We're seeing higher yields in the bond market, and we're seeing a lower dollar because it's weakness. If you have a stronger economy, that is supposed to also be reflected within that nation's currency. These markets are busted. They are broken. And we have a 10-year junk U.S. that hit 1.6% in today's trading session. It's now about 1.5. We'll get to that when we go through market performance. That's how fragile these markets are. We cannot tolerate an interest rate, a yield on the 10-year note, at 1.5% without having the stock market throw a tantrum, have a hissy fit, sell off 2, 3, 4% today, depending on the index. That's how fake all of this junk is and has been. And I've been talking about this for the past 2 years on this podcast, Capital Economics Presentations, how fragile the system is. We could not tolerate a federal funds rate, the rate at which the Federal Open Market Committee, the Federal Reserve, they set that rate, 2.25% back in the fourth quarter of 2018. Couldn't tolerate it. Couldn't tolerate a 10-year note at 3%, 3.25%. Back in the fourth quarter of 2018, all hell broke loose, a 20% decline in the stock market within the fourth quarter. Boom, presto, Federal Reserve does a 180. Oh no, we're not going to taper anymore. We're going to stop that. We're going to be data dependent. We're going to see what happens. And then they are off to the races to cut interest rates. And then we know what happened through 2019. We know the repo crisis. And then, of course, COVID-19 and the collapse last year. Cannot tolerate it. We've thrown an additional $4 trillion into our debt, into our system, a national debt that's about to hit $28 trillion. This ain't free, folks. It's very, very expensive. Throw $4 trillion, it's not just going to cost us $4 trillion. It's going to cost us $4 trillion plus interest. This is destroying so much innovation, so much future prosperity. It's a crime. As I always say, it's unethical, immoral, and un-American, but that doesn't stop us. In fact, we're going to do more of it. And I don't want to hear the argument politically about Democrats and Republicans and somebody's doing something for the people and somebody's being stubborn. They're all idiots. They've all caused this mess, and they continue to do the same thing. Please leave them. They do not like you. They do not care about you. They do not care about you. Don't give them your vote. Don't give them your respect. They don't earn it. They don't deserve it. Leave them. Because they're destroying this country. So wake up to that fact, please. So if you have this robust, strong economy coming back at a GDP 5, 6, 7%, whatever BS number they want to give us, then why can't we tolerate Treasury yields at 1.5%? Now, this could be short-lived. Perhaps it reverses. Nothing goes straight up. Nothing goes straight down. Maybe it'll start to consolidate. But central banks are going to come in to attempt to do something. Federal governments are going to come in and attempt to do something. And again, the question goes back, will the markets buy it for another leg higher? They very well may. They very well may. They've pushed this experiment a lot further than what I thought. And that's my fault for being hopeful and optimistic that people would have called BS on this a long time ago, so that we could start to rebuild from a solid foundation. It appears we're not going to be anywhere near being proactive, and what we are doing reactively are the wrong things. So I guess we're just going to have to hit rock bottom. That's the sad truth of it. And at the same time, we have mortgage rates hitting a six-month high. So we have mortgage rates now going up because, of course, they're linked to the 10-year, okay, which we talk about here all the time. That's why it's something to keep an eye on. And we have a booming housing market. Prices at all-time highs. So you used to say, well, mortgage rates at all-time lows, well, at least, okay, some prices might be going up a little bit here or there, but the mortgage rates are so low, the payment is affordable. Now you're going to have an increase in payments and an increase in the price. People are going to get wiped out when this thing comes to an end. They're going to be underwater before they know it. And you still have very lackadaisical oversight and underwriting standards with this stuff. Don't kid yourself. We didn't learn anything from the great financial crisis. People are broke. People don't have the money. People don't have 20% to put down, especially on housing prices that continue to go up. So it's the same song and dance. It's the same garbage. So what'll happen when this thing collapses, which it's going to? People going to walk away like they did in the great financial crisis because they didn't put that much down, so there's really not that much into it. They're just going to have to take a hit on their credit score. Whip-de-doo. People aren't going to care. We're setting ourselves up for complete and utter failure, and so many people are going to get wiped out, and a lot of them aren't even going to see it coming. And this is easy stuff. This is not difficult. It's easy to connect these dots to paint this picture. And of course, there wasn't an idiot in the Senate or in Congress this week when they had Jay Powell in front of them asking him these types of questions, pressing him on this. And we had a couple members of the Federal Reserve, a couple Fed presidents come out today trying to calm the markets and saying, oh no, we don't have to worry about yields going up. And if they are, that's perfectly fine because that's emblematic of economic growth. Ah, is it? Is it emblematic of economic growth? And again, why do you continue to implement QE and other processes? Basic questions. Dollar index is at 90 spot 37, up about 25 basis points at the time of this podcast. There was a lot of currency volatility today as well, as you can imagine. A lot of the major pairs, I believe, were hitting some technical resistance levels, and you got a little bit of a bounce back off of that. But nonetheless, and we're continuing to see that in the overnight session. You got the British pound giving back about 37 basis points, the Australian dollar giving back 44 basis points, and the New Zealand dollar giving back 25 basis points against the U.S. dollar. Those are sizable moves, and some of the moves were even bigger earlier in the day session. Bitcoin is at $46,900 a coin, so that continues its decline. So we'll see what happens there. Overnight futures trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 0.4%, as is the S&P 500. The NASDAQ 100 is giving back another 1%. That's the tech sector. That's where a lot of this volatility is taking place. What leads up leads down, as we've been saying here for a long time. Cash trade in Japan is giving back 3.4% right now. That's a loss of over 1,000 points. The Nikkei 225 is at 29,140 points at the time of this podcast. A sea of red across the pond in Europe. The exception being the Spanish market is putting on a gain of 0.6%. The Australian cash trade down a little over 2%, as are Chinese stocks, as are Indian stocks. So this is now global, of course, no surprise there. On the stock market front, Apple giving back 3.5%, Tesla giving back another 8%, down 8%, up 8%, down. I mean, how many times do we have to go through this? Tesla is a penny stock. It will be the poster child of this bubble. Make no mistake about it. Tesla's at $682 a share. Microsoft giving back 2.25%. Amazon giving back 3.25%. Facebook giving back 3.6% on the day. And the list continues. On the commodity front, giving back a little as well. WTI at $62.80 a barrel. Brent, $66.19. Natural gas, $2.75. Not a great day for gold or silver. Gold at $1,762 an ounce. Silver at $27.07. So we were at a 28 handle yesterday on silver, back down to 27.08. So that's something to be mindful of. However, the markets, I believe, are misplacing what's going on. They're perhaps buying the narrative that this is actual economic growth that is driving these yields higher and not inflation. And so they think, well, we can get out of the quote-unquote safe haven assets of gold and silver and some other commodities. I think that's a mistake. But mistakes are our opportunities. Now, of course, I'm a long-term bull when it comes to precious metals and commodities. You know, gold and silver have proven the test of time. Gold and silver are money, and they have commercial and industrial uses as well. There are a lot of tailwinds behind the precious metal space and commodities, whether that's metals, whether that's energy, whether that's food, agricultural goods. This is far from over. And if they're going to continue to throw liquidity into the system, where else are you going to look? This is where you have to look, is at gold and silver. This is not their first rodeo. It's Bitcoin's first rodeo, and if you want to bet the farm on Bitcoin, be my guest. It's your risk. It's your ass. Have fun. Knock yourself out. But do you really want to put that type of money into something that has only been around for 10 years while we're in the midst of the largest, most perverse and asinine economic experiment ever put into motion? How does that even make sense? Gold and silver has been here. They saw the Greek Empire come and go. The Persians, the Russians, the British, the Romans. One Chinese dynasty after the next. And people think it's an old relic now. If you try to get into a debate or an argument with somebody who's a big Bitcoin supporter. That's just more proof positive of how crazy everything is in this market. Everybody wants the lottery ticket. Everybody wants Easy Street. I understand it. But that's just not how things work. So that's that. And then, of course, Uncle Sam's 10-year junk note, like we've said, is right at 1.5%. Let me just bring up the 30-year long bond here. Let's see what that's trading at. 1 second. 30-year is at 2.29%. Haven't been there since last February. And, of course, last February it was on the downslope. Now we are very much so on the upslope. So the Fed is getting nervous. I don't care what they say. They are going to come in, yield curve control. They're going to justify more purchases to get these yields lower at some point. Now, the rise that they've had, that we've witnessed, like I said, nothing goes straight up. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's some sort of relief, if you will, and there's a pullback. But the question is, how sustained will that pullback be? Because I think net-net, the inflationary pressures that are coming, that are here, are going to continue to drive these yields higher. And it'll, of course, have a negative effect also on the U.S. dollar as well as other currencies around the globe. Again, supply and demand. All right, it is Thursday, so we have the Department of Labor releasing the initial jobless claims coming in for the week ending February 20th at 730,000 on a seasonally adjusted basis. Again, 730,000. This is the lowest reading we have seen since last November. Very hard to believe. And yet that is still some, 70,000 higher than where we were during the depths of the great financial crisis, the GFC. Again, to put that into perspective. For the previous week, there was a downward revision of some 20,000, so it's nice to see a downward revision. But February 13th, we had 841,000 with a downward revision on a seasonally adjusted basis. On a non-seasonally adjusted basis for the prior week, 710,000. All right. For the week ending February 13th, this will be for continuing claims on a seasonally adjusted basis, we have 4.4 million. Non-seasonally adjusted, it comes in at 4.8. Again, that's for continued jobless claims. With respect to the pandemic unemployment assistance for the week ending February 20th, 451,000. That's a week-over-week decrease of some 61,000. When we take the aggregate, all Americans claiming some form of unemployment insurance, regular state, federal employees, newly discharged veterans, the PUA program, the PEUC program, extended benefits, state additional benefits and workshare, we get a grand total of 19 million in change. That is a week over week increase of 701,000. This will be for the week ending February 6th. The grand total lags by a couple of weeks. Again, 19 million in change, a week over week increase of 701,000. We've been seeing some of this wild volatility, some of these big swings week to week with respect to all programs. The biggest decreases were in regular state, down 69,000. The PUA program giving back about 167,000. And extended benefits, a week over week decrease of 68,000. The biggest increase week over week was with the PEUC program gaining over 1 million. Now, of course, the PUA and the PEUC are some of the children out of Nobody Cares Act 1.0, which are there to allow Americans who would formerly not typically qualify for regular state unemployment benefits the opportunity to qualify for a program. And if your regular state unemployment benefits should expire, you can also go on either one depending on how you qualify. And then there's also extended benefits. That's more state by state as to how they manage their various unemployment insurance programs. And we've been seeing some decreases there. But for the, I'm going to give you a total here when it comes to PUA. Again, as of the week ending February 6th, we got about 7.5 million Americans on PUA. We got about 5.1 million Americans on PEUC. We have about 1.4 million on extended benefits, and we have about 4.9 million on regular state unemployment. Again, that goes back February 6th. So again, with about 19 million in change, that gives us a de facto unemployment rate of about 13.4%. That is double what the Bureau of Labor Statistics tells us is the official unemployment rate at 6.7%. And of course, we had Jay Powell come out a couple weeks ago and tell us, well, that number's not even right. It's really closer to 10%, which is profound. That was news because the Federal Reserve rarely, if ever, comes out and contradicts an official government statistic unless it's in their favor. And the only reason and the only way that this can be in their favor to come out and say that the real unemployment rate is higher than the official is because of the narrative that they have to sell, the narrative they have to spin. And that narrative is, well, we have a dual mandate of price stability. Ain't wrong, they failed there in full employment. Ain't wrong, they failed there too. But if we can pass the $1.9 trillion monstrosity, well, we might achieve full employment sometime next year. So you have to say, look, the real unemployment rate's higher, so we need to do something. The Fed can only do so much. But if Congress gets involved, well, now they can blame Congress. And they can also just go, hey, all we're doing is facilitating it. We're just financing it. That's all we're doing. You can blame Congress and the slippery little slimy, greasy weasel that Jay Powell is. And it doesn't matter what person it is at the Federal Reserve, but he was the one testifying this week, and he was asked, of course, should Congress pass the $1.9 trillion? And he said, oh, no, I'm not going to give an opinion on that, even though he wants Congress to do more. So just say it. You want it. You want it. But if he admits to it, then, oh, he's tied to it. Oh, now he's tied to it. Now he can be blamed for it. Now the Federal Reserve can be blamed for it. We'll finance it, but, you know, it's up to you guys, really. And then they claim that they want independence. This is all a joke. It really, truly is. Hope you're waking up to that. All right. Federal Reserve's balance sheet at a new record all-time high, $7.59 trillion. $7.59 trillion, a week-over-week increase of some $30 billion. This is likely going to hit $10 trillion by the end of the year, according to our analysis. Might go further, depending on what the Democrats push through. And we know it's going to be over $8.5 trillion by the end of this year, basically regardless, because you just do the math, $120 billion a month through the remainder of this year. Okay, there you go. Now, M1, M2, money stock. Now, they've done an old switcheroo here. So they've discontinued these stats. They've updated them, they've changed them, and they've changed the definitions of them. Okay, no surprise. And of course, timely, coincidental, whatever you want to call it, with the capital economics presentation of monetary measures, we're right on it once again. So the Federal Reserve used to calculate M1, M2, and M3, M3 being the broadest monetary aggregate. They stopped doing that back during the Great Financial Crisis once after they implemented quantitative easing. This is not a coincidence. They don't want people seeing all the mess that they are doing. So this is the same type of thing. So last week we had M1 at about $6.8 trillion, if memory serves me correctly. It was getting close to $7 trillion. All right. It's now at $18.1 trillion. How could that have happened? Well, they changed the definition. So allow me to read how they've updated this. All right. Starting on February 23rd, 2021, the H.6 statistical release is now published at a monthly frequency and contains only monthly average data needed to construct the monetary aggregates. Weekly average non-seasonally adjusted data will continue to be made available, while weekly average seasonally adjusted data will no longer be provided. Before May 2020, M1 consists of 1. Currency outside the U.S. Treasury, Federal Reserve banks, and the vaults of depository institutions. Number 2. Demand deposits at commercial banks, excluding those amounts held by depository institutions, the U.S. government and foreign banks, and official institutions, less cash items in the process of collection and Federal Reserve float. And 3. other checkable deposits consisting of negotiable order of withdrawal, or NOW, and automatic transfer service, or ATS, accounts at depository institutions, share draft accounts at credit unions, and demand deposits at thrift institutions. Now, here's the change. Beginning May 2020, M1 consisted of all of those other things, but now it also takes into consideration savings deposits, including money market deposit accounts. So seasonally adjusted M1 is constructed by summing currency, demand deposits, and OCDs before May of 2020, or other liquid deposits beginning in May of 2020, each seasonally adjusted separately. Now, I know that's a lot to take. You can look this up, Federal Reserve, FRED, FRED, Federal Reserve Economic Data. Type in M1. It'll still come up, but it's just going to note that it's discontinued. Scroll down and take a gander of how they're changing these definitions. And they're doing the same thing with respect to M2, which is also at record highs, 19.4 trillion in change. This is what they're doing when they always move the goalpost. They always move the goalpost. And there's something else that I was doing, and I've never done it before. I'm still thinking about it, and I am going to share it with the audience. I'm going to do it via Capital Economics presentation. And it's just some trend analysis looking at how the markets move in relation to money supply. And I just have some questions about it. But there was a break in trend recently. And isn't that interesting that I happened to stumble upon this, and the Federal Reserve is now changing the definition of these figures? So they might be looking at it too, or some variation thereof. We'll get to that. But this is what happens. You get close, something's about to break, they move the goalpost, they change the rules. It's a joke. We can't tolerate 1.5%. Think about that. Think about that. We had 6% back in the dot-com era. We can't tolerate 1.5% right now. The economy can't do it. Stock market can't do it. Bond market can't handle it. We're in for a world of trouble. So buckle up, and I hope you're prepared. Stay diversified, stay vigilant, and stay with the Capital News. I am Alex Kritis. Godspeed.